Ahead of them, the mountain threw up its final defense, a huge slab of insurmountable granite facing that climbed into cloudy infinity. At any moment, the gunslinger expected a twist in the stream to bring them upon a high waterfall and the insurmountable smoothness of rock, dead end. But the air here had that odd magnifying quality that is common to high places, and it was another day before they reached that great granite face. The gunslinger began to feel the dreadful tug of anticipation again, the feeling that it was all finally in his grasp. Near the end, he had to fight himself to keep from breaking into a trot. Wait! The boy had stopped suddenly. They faced a sharp elbow bend in the stream. It boiled and frothed with high energy around the eroded hang of a giant sandstone boulder. All that morning they had been in the shadow of the mountains as the canyon narrowed. Jake was trembling violently and his face had gone pale. "What's the matter?" "Let's go back," Jake whispered. "Let's go back, quick." The gunslinger's face was wooden. "Please?" The boy's face was drawn, and his jawline shook with suppressed agony. Through the heavy blanket of stone, they still heard thunder, as steady as machines in the earth. The slice of sky they could see had itself assumed a turbulent, gothic gray above them as warm and cold currents met and warred.
"Please? Please?"
The boy raised a fist as if to strike the gunslinger's chest. "No." The boy's face took on wonder.
"You're going to kill me. He killed me the first time, and you are going to kill me now."
The gunslinger felt the lie on his lips. He spoke it. "You'll be all right. And a greater lie. I'll take care." Jake's face went gray, and he said no more. He put an unwilling hand out, and he and the gunslinger went around the elbow bend. They came face to face with that final rising wall and the man in black. He stood no more than 20 feet above them, just to the right of the waterfall that crashed and spilled from a huge, ragged hole in the rock. Unseen wind rippled and tugged at his hooded robe. He held a staff in one hand. The other hand he held out to them in a mocking gesture of welcome. He seemed a prophet, and below that rushing sky, mounted on a ledge of rock, a prophet of doom, his voice the voice of Jeremiah.
"Gunslinger, how well you fulfill the prophecies of old. Good day, and good day, and good day."
He laughed, the sound echoing ever over the bellow of the falling water. Without a thought, and seemingly without a click of motor relays, the gunslinger had drawn his pistols. The boy cowered to his right and behind a small shadow. Roland fired 3 times before he could gain control of his traitor hands. The echoes bounced their bronze tones against the rock valley that rose around them, over the sound of the wind and water. A spray of granite puffed over the head of the man in black, a second to the left of his hood, a third to the right. He had missed cleanly all 3 times. The man in black laughed, a full, hearty laugh that seemed to challenge the receding echo of gunshots.
"Would you kill all your answers so easily, gunslinger?"
"Come down," the gunslinger said. "Answers all around." Again that huge, derisive laugh.
"It's not your bullets I fear, Roland. It's your idea of answers that scares me."
"Come down."
"The other side, I think," the man in black said. "On the other side we will hold much counsel."
His eyes flicked to Jake, and he added, "Just the two of us." Jake flinched away from him with a small, whining cry, and the man in black turned, his robe swirling in the gray air like a bat wing. He disappeared into the cleft in the rock from which the water spewed at full force. The gunslinger exercised grim will and did not send a bullet after him.
"Would you kill all your answers so easily, gunslinger?"
There was only the sound of wind and water, sounds that had been in this place of desolation for 1,000 years.
Yet the man in black had been here. After these 12 years, Roland had seen him close up, spoken to him. And the man in black had laughed at him. On the other side, we will hold much counsel. The boy looked up at him with dumbly submissive sheep's eyes, his body trembling. For a moment the gunslinger saw the face of Alice, the girl from Tull, superimposed over Jake's, the scar standing out on her forehead like a mute accusation, and he felt brute loathing for them both. It would not occur to him until much later that both the scar on Alice's forehead and the nail he saw spiked through Jake's forehead in his dreams were in the same place. Jake seemed to catch a whiff of his thought, and a moan was dragged from his throat. But it was short. He twisted his lips shut over it. He held the makings of a fine man, perhaps a gunslinger in his own right, if given time. Just the two of us. The gunslinger felt a great and unholy thirst in some deep unknown pit of his body, a thirst no wine could touch. Worlds trembled almost within reach of his fingers, and in some instinctual way he strove not to be corrupted, knowing in his colder mind that such strife was vain, and always would be. It was noon. He looked up, letting the cloudy, unsettled daylight shine for the last time on the all-too-vulnerable sun of his own righteousness. No one ever really pays for it in silver, he thought. The price of any evil, necessary or otherwise, comes due in flesh. Come with me or stay, the gunslinger said. The boy only looked at him mutely. And to the gunslinger, in that final and vital moment of uncoupling from a moral principle, he ceased to be Jake and became only the boy, an impersonality to be moved and used. Something screamed in the windy stillness. He and the boy both heard. The gunslinger began, and after a moment Jake came after. Together they climbed the tumbled rock beside the steely cold falls and stood where the man in black had stood before them. And together they entered in where he had disappeared. The darkness swallowed them. The Slow Mutants. The gunslinger spoke slowly to Jake in the rising and falling inflections of a dream. There were three of us, Cuthbert, Jamie, and I. We weren't supposed to be there because none of us had passed from the time of children. If we had been caught, court would have striked us. But we weren't. I don't think any of the ones that went before us were caught either. Boys must put on their father's pants in private, strut them in front of the mirror, and then sneak them back on their hangers. It was like that. The father pretends he doesn't notice the new way they are hung up, or the traces of boot-polish mustaches still under their noses. You see? The boy said nothing. He had said nothing since they had relinquished the daylight. The gunslinger had talked hectically, feverishly, to fill his silence. He had not looked back at the lights as they passed into the lightlessness beneath the mountains, but the boy had. The gunslinger had read the failing of day in the soft mirror of Jake's cheek, now faint rose, now milk glass, now pallid silver, now the last dusk glow touch of evening, now nothing. The gunslinger had struck a false light, and they had gone on. Now they were camped. No echo from the man in black returned to them. Perhaps he had stopped to rest, too. Or perhaps he floated onward and without running lights through nighted chambers. It was held once a year in the great hall, the gunslinger went on. We called it the Hall of Grandfathers. But it was only the great hall. The sound of dripping water came to their ears. A courting rite. The gunslinger laughed deprecatingly, and the insensate walls made the sound into a loon-like wheeze.
In the old days, the books say it was the welcoming of spring, but civilization, you know. He trailed off, unable to describe the change inherent in that mechanized noun, the death of the romantic and its sterile, carnal revenant, living only a forced respiration of glitter and ceremony, the geometric steps of courtship during the Easter night dance at the Great Hall, which had replaced the mad scribble of love which he could only intuit dimly, hollow grandeur, in the place of mean and sweeping passions which might once have erased souls. "They made something decadent out of it," the gunslinger said. "A play. A game." In his voice was all the unconscious distaste of the ascetic. His face, had there been stronger light to illumine it, would have shown change, harshness, and sorrow. But his essential force had not been cut or diluted. The lack of imagination that still remained in that face was remarkable. "But the ball," the gunslinger said, "the ball." The boy did not speak. There were 5 crystal chandeliers, heavy glass with electric lights. It was all light. It was an island of light. We had sneaked into one of the old balconies, the ones that were supposed to be unsafe. But we were still boys. We were above everything, and we could look down on it. I don't remember that any of us said anything. We only looked, and we looked for hours. There was a great stone table where the gunslingers and their women sat, watching the dancers. A few of the gunslingers danced, but only a few, and they were the young ones. The other ones only sat, and it seemed to me they were half embarrassed in all that light, that civilized light. They were revered ones, the feared ones, the guardians, but they seemed like hostlers in that crowd of cavaliers with their soft women. There were 4 circular tables loaded with food, and they turned all the time. The cook's boys never stopped coming and going. From 7 until 3 the next morning, the tables rotated like clocks, and we could smell roast pork, beef, lobster, chickens, baked apples. There were ices and candies. There were great flaming skewers of meat. And Martin sat next to my mother and father. I knew them even from so high above. And once she and Martin danced, slowly and revolvingly, and the others cleared the floor for them and clapped when it was over. The gunslingers did not clap, but my father stood slowly and held his hands out to her, and she went, smiling. It was a moment of passage, boy, a time such as must be at the tower itself, when things come together and hold and make power in time. My father had taken control, had been acknowledged and singled out. Martin was the acknowledger, my father was the mover. And his wife, my mother, went to him. The connection between them. Betrayer. My father was the last lord of light. The gunslinger looked down at his hands. The boy still said nothing. His face was only thoughtful. "I remember how they danced," the gunslinger said softly. "My mother and Martin the Enchanter. I remember how they danced, revolving slowly together and apart in the old steps of courtship." He looked at the boy, smiling. But it meant nothing, you know. Because power had been passed in some way that none of them knew, but all understood. And my mother was locked, root and rind, to the holder and wielder of that power. Was it not so? She went to him when the dance was over, didn't she? And clasped his hand? Did they applaud? Did the hall ring with it, as those pansy boys and their soft ladies applauded and lauded him? Did it? Did it? Bitter water dripped distantly in the darkness. The boy said nothing. "I remember how they danced," the gunslinger said softly. "I remember how they danced." He looked up at the unseeable stone roof, and it seemed for a moment that he might scream at it, rail at it, challenge it blindly. Those dumb tonnages of insensible granite that bore their tiny lives in its stone intestine. What hand could have held the knife that did my father to his death?
I'm tired, the boy said wistfully.
The gunslinger lapsed into silence, and the boy laid over and put one hand between his cheek and the stone. The little flame in front of them guttered. The gunslinger rolled a smoke. It seemed he could see the crystal light still in the sardonic hall of his memory, hear the shout of accolade, empty in a husked land that stood even then hopeless against a gray ocean of time. The island of light hurt him bitterly, and he wished he had never held witness to it, or to his father's cuckoldry. He passed smoke between his mouth and nostrils, looking down at the boy. How we make large circles in earth for ourselves, he thought. How long before the daylight again? He slept. After the sound of his breathing had become long and steady and regular, the boy opened his eyes and looked at the gunslinger with an expression that was very much like love. The last light of the fire caught in one pupil for a moment and was drowned there. He went to sleep. The gunslinger had lost most of his time sense in the desert, which was changeless. He lost the rest of it here in these chambers under the mountains, which were lightless. Neither of them had any means of telling time, and the concept of hours became meaningless. In a sense, they stood outside of time. A day might have been a week, or a week a day. They walked, they slept, they ate thinly. Their only companion was the steady, thundering rush of the water, drilling its auger path through the stone. They followed it, drank from its flat, mineral-salted depth. At times the gunslinger thought he saw fugitive drifting lights like corpse lamps beneath its surface. But supposed they were only projections of his brain, which had not forgotten the light. Still, he cautioned the boy not to put his feet in the water. The range finder in his head took them on steadily. The path beside the river, for it was a path, smooth, sunken to a slight concavity, led always upward toward the river's head. At regular intervals they came to curved stone pylons with sunken ring bolts. Perhaps once oxen or stage horses had tethered there. At each was a steel flagon holding an electric torch, but these were all barren of life and light. During the third period of rest before sleep, the boy wandered away a little. The gunslinger could hear small conversation of rattled pebbles as he moved cautiously. Careful, he said, you can't see where you are.
I'm crawling. It's... Say!
What is it? The gunslinger half-crouched, touching the haft of one gun. There was a slight pause. The gunslinger strained his eyes uselessly.
I think it's a railroad, the boy said dubiously.
The gunslinger got up and walked slowly toward the sound of Jake's voice, leading with one foot lightly to test for pitfalls.
Here!
A hand reached out and cat's-pawed the gunslinger's face. The boy was very good in the dark, better than the gunslinger himself. His eyes seemed to dilate until there was no color left in them. The gunslinger saw this as he struck a meager light. There was no fuel in this rock womb, and what they had brought with them was going rapidly to ash. At times the urge to strike a light was well-nigh insatiable. The boy was standing beside a curved rock wall that was lined with parallel metal staves off into the darkness. Each carried black bulbs that might once have been conductors of electricity. And beside and below, set only inches off the stone floor, were tracks of bright metal. What might have run on those tracks at one time? The gunslinger could only imagine black electric bullets flying through this forever night with affrighted searchlight eyes going before. He had never heard of such things, but there were skeletons in the world just as there were demons.
He had once come upon a hermit who had gained a quasi-religious power over a miserable flock of kine keepers by possession of an ancient gasoline pump. The hermit crouched beside it, one arm wrapped possessively around it, and preached wild, guttering, sullen sermons. He occasionally placed the still bright steel nozzle, which was attached to a rotted rubber hose, between his legs. On the pump, in perfectly legible, although rust-clotted letters, was a legend of unknown meaning: Amoco, lead-free. Amoco had become the totem of a thunder god, and they had worshipped him with the half-mad slaughter of sheep. Hulks, the gunslinger thought. Only meaningless hulks in sands that once were seas. And now a railroad. "We'll follow it," he said. The boy said nothing. The gunslinger extinguished the light, and they slept. When the gunslinger awoke, the boy was up before him, sitting on one of the rails and watching him sightlessly in the dark. They followed the rails like blind men, the gunslinger leading, the boy following. They slipped their feet along one rail always, also like blind men. The steady rush of the river off to the right was their companion. They did not speak, and this went on for three periods of waking. The gunslinger felt no urge to think coherently or to plan. His sleep was dreamless. During the fourth period of waking and walking, they literally stumbled on a handcar. The gunslinger ran into it chest high, and the boy, walking on the other side, struck his forehead and went down with a cry. The gunslinger made a light immediately. "Are you all right?" The words sounded sharp, almost waspish, and he winced at them. "Yes." The boy was holding his head gingerly. He shook it once to make sure he had told the truth. They turned to look at what they had run into. It was a flat square of metal that sat mutely on the tracks. There was a seesaw handle in the center of the square. The gunslinger had no immediate sense of it, but the boy knew immediately. "It's a hand car." "What?" "Hand car," the boy said impatiently. "Like in the old movies. Look." He pulled himself up and went to the handle. He managed to push it down, but it was necessary to hang all his weight on the handle. He grunted briefly. The handcar moved a foot with silent timelessness on the rails. "It works a little hard," the boy said, as if apologizing for it. The gunslinger pulled himself up and pushed the handle down. The handcar moved forward obediently, then stopped. He could feel a drive shaft turn beneath his feet. The operation pleased him. It was the first old machine, other than the pump at the way station, that he had seen in years, which still worked well. But it disquieted him, too. It would take them to their destination that much quicker. The curse kiss again, he thought. I knew the man in black had meant them to find this, too. "Neat, huh?" the boy said, and his voice was full of loathing. "What are movies?" the gunslinger asked again. Jake still did not answer, and they stood in a black silence, like in a tomb where life had fled. The gunslinger could hear his organs at work inside his body and the boy's respiration. That was all. "You stand on one side, I stand on the other side," Jake said. "You'll have to push by yourself until it gets rolling good. Then I can help. First you push, then I push. We'll go right along. Get it?" "I get it," the gunslinger said. His hands were in helpless, despairing fists. "But you'll have to push by yourself until it gets rolling good," the boy repeated, looking at him. The gunslinger had a sudden, vivid picture of the great hall a year after the spring ball, in the shattered, hulked shards of revolt, civil strife, and invasion. It was followed with the memory of Allie, the woman from Tull with the scar, pushed and pulled by the bullets that were killing her in reflex. It was followed by Jamie's face, blue in death, by Susan's, twisted and weeping. "All my old friends," the gunslinger thought, and smiled hideously. "I'll push," the gunslinger said. He began to push. They rolled on through the dark, faster now, no longer having to feel their way. Once the awkwardness of a buried age had been run off the handcar, it went smoothly. The boy tried to do his share, and the gunslinger allowed him small shifts. But mostly he pumped by himself, in large and chest-stretching rises and fallings. The river was their companion, sometimes closer on their right, sometimes further away. Once it took on huge and thunderous hollowness, as if passing through a prehistoric cathedral narthex. Once the sound of it disappeared almost altogether. The speed and the made wind against their faces seemed to take the place of sight and to put them once again in a frame of time and reference. The gunslinger estimated they were making anywhere from 10 to 15 miles an hour, always on a shallow, almost imperceptible uphill grade that wore him out deceptively. When they stopped, he slept like the stone itself. Their food was almost gone again. Neither of them worried about it. For the gunslinger, the tenseness of a coming climax was as imperceivable, but as real and as accretive as the fatigue of propelling the handcar. They were close to the end of the beginning. He felt like a performer placed on center stage minutes before the rise of the curtain. Settled in position with his first line held in his mind, he heard the unseen audience rattling programs and settling in seats. He lived with a tight, tidy ball of unholy anticipation in his belly, and welcomed the exercise that let him sleep. The boy spoke less and less, but at their stopping place one sleep period before they were attacked by the slow mutants, he asked the gunslinger almost shyly about his coming of age. The gunslinger had been leaning against the handle, a cigarette from his dwindling supply of tobacco clamped in his mouth. He had been on the verge of his usual unthinking sleep when the boy asked his question. "Why would you want to know that?" he asked. The boy's voice was curiously stubborn, as if hiding embarrassment. "I just do." And after a pause, he added, "I always wondered about growing up. It's mostly lies." "It wasn't growing up," the gunslinger said. "I never grew up all at once. I did it one place and another along the way. I saw a man hung once. That was part of it, though I didn't know it then. I left a girl in a place called Kingstown 12 years ago. That was another part. I never knew any of the parts when they happened. Only later I knew that." He realized with some unease that he was avoiding. "I suppose the coming of age was part two," he said, almost grudgingly. "It was formal, almost stylized, like a dance." He laughed unpleasantly. "Like love. Love and dying have been my life." The boy said nothing. "It was necessary to prove oneself in battle," the gunslinger began. Summer, and hot. August had come to the land like a vampire lover, killing the land and the crops of the tenant farmers, turning the fields of the castle city white and sterile. In the west, some miles distant and near the borders that were the end of the civilized world, fighting had already begun. All reports were bad, and all of them palled before the heat that rested over this place of the center. Cattle lolled empty-eyed in the pens of the stockyards. Pigs grunted listlessly, unmindful of knives whetted for the coming fall. People whined about taxes and conscription as they always have, but there was an emptiness beneath the apathetic passion play of politics. The center had frayed like a rag rug that had been washed and walked on and shaken and hung and dried. The lines and nets of mesh which held the last jewel at the breast of the world were unraveling. Things were not holding together. The earth drew in its breath in the summer of the coming eclipse. The boy idled along the upper corridor of this stone place which was home, sensing these things, not understanding. He was also empty and dangerous. It had been 3 years since the hanging of the cook, who had always been able to find snacks for hungry boys, and he had filled out. Now, dressed only in faded denim pants, 14 years old, he had already come to the widened chest span and lengthening legs that would characterize his manhood. He was still unbedded, but two of the younger slatterns of a Westtown merchant had cast eyes on him. He had felt a response, and felt it more strongly now. Even in the coolness of the passage, he felt sweat on his body. Ahead were his mother's apartments, and he approached them incuriously, meaning only to pass them and go upward to the roof, where a thin breeze and the pleasure of his hand awaited. He had passed the door when a voice called him. "You, boy." It was Martin, the enchanter. He was dressed with a suspicious, upsetting casualness, black whipcord trousers almost as tight as leotards, and a white shirt open halfway down his chest. His hair was tousled. The boy looked at him silently. "Come in, come in. Don't stand in the hall. Your mother wants to speak to you." He was smiling with his mouth, but the lines of his face held a deeper, more sardonic humor. Beneath that, there was only coldness. But his mother did not seem to want to see him. She sat in the low back chair by the large window in the central parlor of her apartments, the one which overlooked the hot, blank stone of the central courtyard. She was dressed in a loose, informal gown, and looked at the boy only once, a quick, glinting, rueful smile, like autumn sun on stream water. During the rest of the interview, she studied her hands. He saw her seldom now, and the phantom of cradle songs had almost faded from his brain. But she was a beloved stranger. He felt an amorphous fear, and an uncoalesced hatred for Martin, his father's right-hand man, or was it the other way around, was born. And, of course, there had already been some backstreet talk, talk which he honestly thought he hadn't heard. "Are you well?" she asked him softly, studying her hands. Martin stood beside her, a heavy, disturbing hand near the juncture of her white shoulder and white neck, smiling on them both. His brown eyes were dark to the point of blackness with smiling. "Yes," he said. "Your studies go well?" "I'm trying," he said. They both knew he was not flashingly intelligent like Cuthbert, or even quick like Jamie. He was a plodder and a bludgeoner. "And David?" She knew his affection for the hawk. The boy looked up at Martin, still smiling paternally down on all this. Past his prime. His mother seemed to wince. For a moment, Martin's face seemed to darken, his grip on her shoulder tighten. Then she looked out into the hot whiteness of the day, and all was as it had been. "It's a charade," he thought. "A game. Who is playing with whom?" "You have a scar on your forehead," Martin said, still smiling. "Are you going to be a fighter like your father, or are you just slow?" This time she did wince. "Both," the boy said. He looked steadily at Martin and smiled painfully. Even in here it was very hot. Martin stopped smiling abruptly. "You can go to the roof now, boy. I believe you have business there." But Martin had misunderstood, underestimated. They had been speaking in the low tongue, a parody of informality. But now the boy flashed into high speech. "My mother has not yet dismissed me, bondsman." Martin's face twisted as if quirt-lashed. The boy heard his mother's dreadful, woeful gasp. She spoke his name. But the painful smile remained intact on the boy's face, and he stepped forward. "Will you give me a sign of fealty, bondsman, in the name of my father whom you serve?" Martin stared at him, rankly unbelieving. "Go," Martin said gently. "Go and find your hand." Smiling, the boy went. As he closed the door and went back the way he came, he heard his mother wail. It was a banshee sound. Then he heard Martin's laugh. The boy continued to smile as he went to his test. Jamie had come from the shopwives, and when he saw the boy crossing the exercise yard, he ran to tell Roland the latest gossips of bloodshed and revolt to the west. But he fell aside, the words all unspoken. They had known each other since the time of infancy, and as boys they had dared each other, cuffed each other, and made a thousand explorations of the walls within which they had both been birthed. The boy strode past him, staring without seeing, grinning his painful grin. He was walking toward Court's cottage, where the shades were drawn to ward off the savage afternoon heat. Court napped in the afternoon so that he could enjoy his evening tomcat forays into the mazed and filthy brothels of the lower town to the fullest extent. Jamie knew in a flash of intuition, knew what was to come, and in his fear and ecstasy he was torn between following Roland and going after the others. Then his hypnotism was broken, and he ran toward the main building, screaming, "Cuthbert! Alan! Thomas!" His scream sounded puny and thin in the heat. They had known, all of them, in that invisible way boys have, that the boy would be the first of them to try the line. But this was too soon. The hideous grin on Roland's face galvanized him as no news of wars, revolts, and witchcrafts could have done. This was more than words from a toothless mouth given over fly-specked heads of lettuce. Roland walked to the cottage of his teacher and kicked the door open. It slammed backward, hit the plain, rough plaster of the wall, and rebounded. He had never been here before. The entrance opened on an austere kitchen that was cool and brown. A table, two straight chairs, two cabinets, a faded linoleum floor, tracked in black paths from the cooler set in the floor to the counter where knives hung to the table. A public man's privacy here. The last faded sobriety of a violent midnight carouser who had loved the boys of three generations roughly and had made some of them into gunslingers. "Court?" He kicked the table, sending it across the room and into the counter. Knives from the wall rack fell in twinkling jackstraws. There was thick stirring in the other room, a half-sleep clearing of the throat. The boy did not enter, knowing it was sham, knowing that Court had awakened immediately in the cottage's other room and stood with one glittering eye beside the door, waiting to break the intruder's unwary neck. "Court! I want you, bondsman!" Now he spoke the high speech, and Court swung the door open. He was dressed only in thin underwear shorts, a squat man with bow legs, runneled with scars from top to toe, thick with twists of muscle. There was a round, bulging belly. The boy knew from experience that it was spring steel. The one good eye glared at him from the bashed and dented hairless head. The boy saluted formally. "Teach me no more, bondsman. Today I teach you." "You are early, Puler," he said casually, but he also spoke the high speech. "5 years early, I should judge. I will ask only once. Will you renege?" The boy only smiled his hideous, painful smile. For Court, who had seen the smile on a score of bloodied, scarlet-skied fields of honor and dishonor, it was answer enough. Perhaps the only answer he would have believed. "It's too bad," the teacher said absently. "You have been a most promising pupil, the best in 2 dozen years, I should say. It will be sad to see you broken and set upon a blind path. But the world has moved on. Bad times are on horseback." The boy still did not speak, and would have been incapable of any coherent explanation had it been required, but for the first time the awful smile softened a little. "Still, there is the line of blood," Court said somberly. "Revolt and witchcraft to the west or no. I am your bondsman, boy. I recognize your command and bow to it now, if never again, with my heart." And Court, who had cuffed him, kicked him, bled him, cursed him, made mock of him and called him the very eye of syphilis, bent to one knee and bowed his head.
The boy touched the leathery, vulnerable flesh of his neck with wonder. "Rise, bondsman. In love." Court stood slowly, and there might have been pain behind the impassive mask of his reamed features. "This is waste. Renege, boy. I break my own oath. Renege and wait." The boy said nothing. "Very well." Court's voice became dry and businesslike. "1 hour, and the weapon of your choice. You will bring your stick?" "I always have." "How many sticks have been taken from you, Court?" Which was tantamount to asking how many boys have entered the square yard beyond the great hall and returned as gunslinger apprentices. "No stick will be taken from me today," Court said slowly. "I regret it. There is only the once, boy. The penalty for overeagerness is the same as the penalty for unworthiness. Can you not wait?" The boy recalled Martin standing over him, tall as mountains. "No." "Very well. What weapon do you choose?" The boy said nothing. Court's smile showed a jagged ring of teeth. "Wise enough to begin in 1 hour. You realize you will in all probability never see the others or your father or this place again."
"I know what exile means," he said softly.
"Go now." The boy went without looking back. The cellar of the barn was spuriously cool, dank, smelling of cobwebs and earth water. It was lit from the ubiquitous sun, but felt none of the day's heat. The boy kept the hawk here, and the bird seemed comfortable enough. David was old now and no longer hunted the sky. His feathers had lost the radiant animal brightness of 3 years ago, but the eyes were still as piercing and motionless as ever. "You cannot friend a hawk," they said, "unless you are a hawk yourself, alone and only a sojourner in the land, without friends or the need of them. The hawk pays no coinage to morals." David was an old hawk now. The boy hoped, or was he too unimaginative to hope, did he only know, that he himself was a young one. "Hi," he said softly, and extended his arm to the tethered perch. The hawk stepped onto the boy's arm and stood motionless, unhooded. With his other hand, the boy reached into his pocket and fished out a bit of dried jerky. The hawk snapped it deftly from between his fingers and made it disappear. The boy began to stroke David very carefully. Court most probably would not have believed it if he had seen it, but Court did not believe the boy's time had come either. "I think you die today," he said, continuing to stroke. "I think you will be made sacrifice, like all those little birds we trained you on. Do you remember? No? It doesn't matter. After today, I am the hawk." David stood on his arm, silent and unblinking, indifferent to his life or death. "You are old," the boy said reflectively. "And perhaps not my friend. Even 1 year ago you would have had my eyes instead of that little string of meat, isn't it so? Court would laugh. But if we get close enough, which is it, bird? Age or friendship?" David did not say. The boy hooded him and found the jesses, which were looped at the end of David's perch. They left the barn. The yard behind the great hall was not really a yard at all, but only a green corridor whose walls were formed by tangled, thick-grown hedges. It had been used for the rite of coming of age since time out of mind, long before Court and his predecessor, who had died of a stab wound from an overzealous hand in this place. Many boys had left the corridor from the east end, where the teacher always entered, as men. The east end faced the great hall and all the civilization and intrigue of the lighted world.
Many more had slunk away, beaten and bloody, from the West End, where the boys always entered, as boys forever. The West End faced the mountains and the hut dwellers. Beyond that, the tangled barbarian forests, and beyond that, the desert. The boy who became a man progressed from darkness and unlearning to light and responsibility. The boy who was beaten could only retreat forever and forever. The hallway was as smooth and green as a gaming field. It was exactly 50 yards long. Each end was usually clogged with tense spectators and relatives, for the ritual was usually forecast with great accuracy. 18 was the most common age. Those who had not made their test by the age of 25 usually slipped into obscurity as freeholders, unable to face the brutal all-or-nothing fact of the field and the test. But on this day there were none but Jamie, Cuthbert, Alan, and Thomas. They clustered at the boy's end, gape-mouthed and frankly terrified. "Your weapon, stupid!" Cuthbert hissed in agony. "You forgot your weapon!" "I have it," the boy said distantly. Dimly he wondered if the news of this had reached yet to the central buildings, to his mother and Martin. His father was on a hunt, not due back for weeks. In this he felt a sense of shame, for he felt that in his father he would have found understanding, if not approval. "Has Court come?"
"Court is here."
The voice came from the far end of the corridor, and Court stepped into view, dressed in a short singlet. A heavy leather band encircled his forehead to keep sweat from his eyes. He held an ironwood stick in one hand, sharp on one end, heavily blunted and spatulate on the other. He began the litany which all of them, chosen by the blind blood of their fathers, had known since early childhood, learned against the day when they would, perchance, become men.
"Have you come here for a serious purpose, boy?"
"I have come for a serious purpose, teacher."
"Have you come as an outcast from your father's house?"
"I have so come, teacher, and would remain outcast until he had bested Court. If Court bested him, he would remain outcast forever."
"Have you come with your chosen weapon?"
"I have so come, teacher."
"What is your weapon?"
This was the teacher's advantage, his chance to adjust his plan of battle to the sling or the spear or the net. "My weapon is David, teacher."
Court halted only briefly. "So then, have you at me, boy?"
"I do."
"Be swift, then."
And Court advanced into the corridor, switching his pike from one hand to the other. The boys sighed flutteringly like birds as their compatriot stepped to meet him. "My weapon is David, teacher." Did Court remember? Had he fully understood? If so, perhaps it was all lost. It turned on surprise, and on whatever stuff the hawk had left in him. Would he only sit, disinterested, on the boy's arm while Court struck him brainless with the ironwood, or seek the high, hot sky? They drew close together, and the boy loosened the hawk's hood with nerveless fingers. It dropped to the green grass, and the boy halted in his tracks. He saw Court's eyes drop to the bird and widen with surprise and slow-dawning comprehension. "Now then,
at him!"
the boy cried and raised his arm. And David flew like a silent brown bullet, stubby wings pumping once, twice, three times, before crashing into Court's face, talons and beak searching.
"Hi, Roland!"
Cuthbert screamed deliriously. Court staggered backwards, off balance. The ironwood staff rose and beat futilely at the air about his head. The hawk was an undulating, blurred bundle of feathers. The boy arrowed forward, his hand held out in a straight wedge, his elbow locked. Still, Court was almost too quick for him. The bird had covered 90% of his vision, but the ironwood came up again, spatulate end forward, and Court cold-bloodedly performed the only action that could turn events at that point. He beat his own face three times, biceps flexing mercilessly. David fell away, broken and twisted. One wing flapped at the ground frantically. His cold predator's eyes stared fiercely into the teacher's bloody, streaming face. Court's bad eye now bulged blindly from its socket. The boy delivered a kick to Court's temple, connecting solidly. It should have ended it. His leg had been numbed by Court's only blow, but it still should have ended it. It did not. For a moment, Court's face went slack, and then he lunged, grabbing for the boy's foot.